Welcome to this audio issue of Porter Stansberry's Complete Investor, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. This issue was originally published on Thursday, January 15, 2026, where Mr. Market goes for data. Safe as a bond. With all the equity upside. Frank Luke had just popped his last balloon. With hydrogen flames whooshing in his face, and the canvas wings of his biplane fighter spat in tatters, the 21-year-old American ace pilot banked sharply over the French town of Margaux and nosed down for cover. He demolished three German sausages, tethered observation balloons, in 15 minutes flat. And now, a squad of Fokker D-7s were on his tail as anti-aircraft shells exploded around him. He made the treeline past Margaux. Just. Luke, known as the Arizona Balloon Buster, held the American record for the most popped balloons, 14 downed in just 17 days. A surly young lieutenant with a chip on his shoulder, he defy orders to take a 42-hour breather and hop right back in the cockpit after a successful kill. Up until this evening in September 1918, his swagger had served him well. It was the height of World War I, and over a million newly enlisted American doughboys had just hopped off the boat in Europe, eager to help their allies fight the German menace. At the heart of that conflict was a heated, and now, largely forgotten, battle over balloons. Balloonomania kicked off in the late 1700s when the Montgolfier brothers sent up a sheep, a duck, and a rooster in a hot air balloon, and picked up steam over the next century as amateur ballooning societies sprang up all over America and Europe. Observation balloons appeared in the Napoleonic Wars and the U.S. Civil War, and by the early 1900s, governments realized that the lighter-than-air fad might have serious surveillance possibilities. Enter the caquats. 90 by 30-foot captive hydrogen balloons, tethered to sturdy winches and floating as high as 4,000 feet in the air. Swinging from the ropes beneath were two man wicker baskets, equipped with mini-field communication offices and connected to the ground by telephone. With a good pair of binoculars, the balloonist could see 40 miles into enemy territory. With a portable camera, he could take pictures for creating scale maps. And, with a newfangled invention called a parachute strapped to his back, he could get away quickly if a balloon buster plane scored a hit. In a low-tech world before drones or helicopters, these oblong sausages were a game-changer. By 1908, the U.S. Army had launched a full-fledged military aeronautics school to train would-be balloonatics. The saying went, you had to be a lunatic to climb into one of the wicker baskets. In 1918, 26 squadrons of U.S. planes, along with around 30 balloons, unloaded in France, ready to hammer a weak spot in the German lines at Saint-Mihiel. The Germans were ready with planes and balloons of their own, and Saint-Mihiel quickly exploded into the largest and bloodiest air battle of World War I. The balloons weren't as fragile as you might think. Tightly woven from multiple layers of fabric and rubber, they tended to leak slowly, but not pop. However, if a hot shell penetrated the hydrogen-filled chamber, the balloon would explode in a massive fireball, often spelling death for attackers. To sweeten the deal, the Germans allowed their pilots to log 1.5 kills for every balloon they demolished. Sometimes, of course, the busters got busted. Frank Luke's war ended just beyond the village of Margaux, in a muddy pasture where the Germans swarmed his crippled Spad. Firing a hand pistol, he refused to surrender, and the Krauts shot him, stripped him of everything but his wristwatch, and threw him into a hole. It was the watch that ultimately helped identify his bones and bring him home for a hero's burial. He received a posthumous Medal of Honor, as well he should. At $7,000 per sausage, $177,000 today, plus the priceless intel they delivered, a burst balloon was a major catastrophe, or a major coup, depending on which side you were on. American fighter pilot Eddie Rickenbacker summed it up, "The safety of thousands of our attacking soldiers depended upon our success in eliminating these all-watching eyes of the enemy." To guard their eyes in the sky, a complicated infrastructure sprang into place on both sides, lookouts stationed in trees near each balloon, nimble fighter planes patrolling the airspace around the giant windbags, and on the ground, a battery of dedicated anti-aircraft artillery called Archies. The Archies are where math whiz J.B. Lovelace stepped in. Kindergarten math. Hitting a moving target from the ground, as anyone who's tried skeet shooting knows, is more challenging than it appears. The Archies were deadly, cannons that shot 13-pound flaming onion shells, but the problem was targeting the nimble German balloon buster planes, while not hitting the balloons themselves. Lovelace, a math nerd who'd enlisted as an officer in 1917, thought trigonometry sines and cosines might have something to do with it, and he was right. As he'd later outline in the Army's Manual of Anti-Aircraft Artillery, You could calculate a triangle for each hit that looks something like this, and you'd be far more likely to get a kill. After completing officer training camp, Lovelace was quickly assigned to a special group designing anti-aircraft artillery, where he perfected a rudimentary computerized gun sight. Lovelace's mathematical guns got the credit for the very first German plane downed by US forces in France. He kept a piece of debris from that plane's fuselage in his basement for the rest of his life. By the end of the four-day Saint-Mihiel conflict, a lot more Krauts went down in flames. General Mitchell's 1,500-plane air armada, the largest of World War I, saw 18,500 Germans dead or captured, with only 7,000 losses on the American side of the ledger. The momentum from Saint-Mihiel swept the Allies straight into the Meuse-Argonne offensive, the final campaign of the war. Lovelace's modded Archies continued to do a bang-up job protecting balloons. By the time the Germans surrendered in November 1918, the Allied forces had lost only 89 out of 265 total balloons to aircraft attacks, and, astonishingly, had suffered only one balloonist casualty, Cleo J. Ross, whose parachute caught on fire. Lovelace, now a captain, headed stateside, along with his new buddy Ed McCrone, who he'd met during training camp in the next alphabetically assigned bunk. They set up shop together in Michigan as a brokerage firm called E. McCrone & Company, and for the rest of the Roaring Twenties, as the old song went, life was just a bowl of cherries. Lovelace holed up and did sums while McCrone dove into the exciting world of leverage. And toward the end of the decade, Lovelace started to realize that the math didn't add up. One big bank that he analyzed had a stock market value equal to its total assets, as though the bank didn't have any liabilities at all. Citing what he called kindergarten financial research, he tried to convince McCrone that all was not well. Later, he explained, "The bank incident scared me so much that I did the same simple arithmetic with a lot of other companies. I found that people were climbing all over each other to buy 100 shares or 10,000 shares of those hot stocks, but no one in his right mind would buy the whole company at such a high price. That's what got me out of the market. It was a very simple lesson. Don't pay more per share for a company's stock than you'd be willing to pay if you were buying the whole company." Even though McCrone had seen firsthand how well Lovelace's kindergarten math worked during the war, trigonometry is just triangles, after all, he wasn't convinced. McCrone doubled down with more leverage, and in summer 1929, Lovelace pulled out. Leaving a small bit of his own capital in the firm so his wartime buddy wouldn't feel embarrassed, 34-year-old Lovelace moved to cash, hopped on a train, and headed for sunny California, where he'd purchased a date farm with his brothers. And in October 1929, like a well-placed shell hitting a cocoon, the market popped. McCrone & Company, now, just McCrone, had no parachute. By 1930, his firm had dissolved completely. Lovelace, though, with his chunk of capital and his genius for arithmetic, survived and thrived. Quickly tiring of the fruit business, he started his own investment firm, first focusing on conservatively managed mutual funds, and then branching out into international investing. Without much fanfare, just crunching on glamorous numbers, his company quietly grew into the world's largest active fund manager, with over $3 trillion currently under management. Along the way, in 1968, Lovelace's firm developed a first-of-its-kind series of equity indexes that today are used to benchmark more $26 trillion in assets. It's that product, now trading independently as a $44 billion public company, that we are recommending in this issue. The term benchmark has evolved to refer to the process of comparing performance between competing products or processes. The distinction is the difference between thinking about things in absolute versus relative terms. When something is absolute, it is not debatable. On the other hand, a relative factor is comparative, by definition connected or influenced by other factors. Looking at things in relative terms applies context, something that is important in an increasingly complex world. For anyone in the investing world, this is a critical distinction. The calendar just flipped to a new year, and it is typical for investors to take a look back and assess performance. Let's say a stock was up 10% for the year. That's a nice return. But what if we compared it to the S&P 500 return of 17%? Then all of a sudden that stock doesn't seem so hot. But what if that stock was much lower risk than the broader market, or paid a much bigger dividend, or any other number of factors that might muddy the waters? Evaluating investments can be much more complicated than simply looking at one number on the page. That's where benchmarking comes in. Building a business on benchmarks. MSCI, NYSE. MSCI is a leading provider of investment decision support tools for the global financial community. The company has been at the leading edge of data collection and industry technology for more than 50 years. This stock checks all the boxes of a high-quality investment. The business has a wide moat preventing competitors from encroaching on its territory. A highly recurring revenue stream that investors can count on. high profit margins that reflect a dominant market position, strong free cash flow generation. Companies like this usually garner very high valuations. Because MSCI usually trades at a higher valuation than it does now, investors have a rare opportunity to buy this gem on sale. Think of this as the safety of a super high quality bond but with big equity upside. Now that's a way for investors to compound their wealth without taking big risks. MSCI's products and services include indexes, portfolio construction and risk management tools, sustainability and climate solutions, and analysis and data on private assets. MSCI supports all types of investors in an increasingly complex global landscape. This includes institutional asset managers, pension funds, hedge funds, and commercial banks. The MS in MSCI is from Morgan Stanley, where the firm began and was originally known as the company's Capital International Division. The foundations of MSCI's indexes started in 1969 when the division introduced the first comprehensive global equity indexes covering non-US markets. These indexes became essential benchmarks for international investing. In 1986, Morgan Stanley licensed the rights to these indexes and rebranded them as MSCI indexes. By then, MSCI indexes had become the primary benchmarks for global financial markets. In 2007, Morgan Stanley began divesting itself of MSCI with an IPO, and in 2009, MSCI became fully independent after the parent company completed its spin-off. MSCI's products allow clients to better understand and analyze the biggest drivers of risk and returns. That allows those clients to build their investment portfolios confidently and efficiently. These are mission-critical products, including benchmarking, index-linked products, and portfolio risk management. MSCI's key business segments. In 2025, the company should generate about $3.1 billion in revenue, representing more than 10% annual growth over the last 10 years, and 2025 EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, dividends, and amortization, should be almost $1.9 billion, a little more than a 10% increase over 2024. MSCI serves approximately 6,900 total clients in over 95 countries. The company provides that support with just over 6,250 employees in over 30 office locations globally. MSCI divides its business into four operating segments as shown below. The index segment generated 57% of company revenue in Q3 2025, the company's largest segment and the crown jewel of the franchise. Indexed investing really started gaining traction in the 1970s, and then gained steam in the 1990s with exchange-traded funds, ETF. Index investing is a passive investment strategy where one puts money into a vehicle like an ETF or mutual fund designed to match the performance of a specific market index rather than trying to beat the market by picking individual stocks. The strategy offers instant diversification and low costs, but until a couple decades ago, just a small group of ETFs used indexes, like the Standard & Poor's S&P 500 Index ETF, SPY, or the Invesco QQQ Trust, QQQ, which tracks the NASDAQ 100. Today, that ETF pie has grown dramatically in terms of both the number of different index strategies and the amount of dollars flowing in. But the use cases for MSCI indexes have exploded well beyond that. One of the principal ways investors use MSCI indexes is as a performance measurement. An investor can pick a group of stocks and measure its return over time, but that is hard to evaluate in isolation. Even if one had the return data for a whole list of investment managers, it isn't as simple as just analyzing numbers. There are many different types of investment strategies with different risk profiles, often making apples and oranges comparisons. To do it effectively, there needs to be a benchmark, a widely accepted measuring stick to make a fair comparison. MSCI's indexes act as standard references to evaluate portfolio returns and manager performance. This allows investors to assess active manager skills, attribute performance, and juxtapose against market standards. And because these can be tailored by geography, company size, and other factors, these indexes provide steady goalposts for accurate comparisons, making the data much more useful for investors. Investors also use MSCI indexes in portfolio construction. To help with that, MSCI develops indexes through research and data analytics to provide a representative sample of potential investment opportunities across geographies, market cap sizes, and other factors. The MSCI ACWI Index, for example, captures large and mid-cap representation across developed and emerging markets. ACWI covers approximately 85% of the global investable equity opportunity set. Having this formalized list allows professional investors to look at their choices in a systematic way. This platform also helps with asset allocation. Using MSCI indexes as benchmarks allows investors to set strategic allocations like making conscious decisions to overweight or underweight developed or emerging markets, specific countries, or industries, ultimately helping create proper diversification. MSCI indexes are important for risk management as well. Indexes guide rebalancing by reflecting market changes, such as adjusting index members and weights on a quarterly basis. They also support scenario analysis, hedging through the use of derivatives and incorporating other asset classes such as fixed income or private equity into portfolios. Today, MSCI indexes are widely used. $18.3 trillion of assets under management, AUM, are currently benchmarked against MSCI indexes. That's $12 trillion in actively managed funds and $6.3 trillion in indexed funds. How MSCI makes money off indexes. While indexes are relatively new to the financial world, their monetization traces back to a centuries-old business model. You may have heard of the business model. It's called subscriptions. The subscription business model was used in Europe beginning in the 1600s. The word subscribe was first formulated in the world of law. To subscribe to something means to sign under. The buyer makes a commitment to repeatedly buy a product, over and over again. Before the internet, subscriptions were most commonly associated with magazines, newspapers, and record clubs. Customers would pay a fee, and, in return, they would get their favorite music or latest publication on a regular basis. Subscription models are evident today across streaming and digital content that replace legacy media. Streaming services like Netflix, Hulu, Disney+, Max, etc. charge a monthly fee for movies and shows. Users of Spotify and Apple Music, to name just two, pay a monthly charge in return for ad-free music. The podcast and blog industries have blossomed, supported, at least in part, by subscriptions. Another pay-as-you-go example, similar to a subscription, is software as a service, SaaS. Companies like Microsoft, MSFT, and Adobe, ADBE, historically sold their products to users for a fixed price. Now software is provided with more of a rent instead of buy approach. Customers pay a monthly or annual fee for those same software programs. Investors like the subscription model because it provides stability and predictability, what is called recurring revenue. Sales that investors can count on year after year. Contrast that with more economically cyclical industries like manufacturing. Cyclical revenue is more volatile as it moves up and down in line with broader macroeconomic trends. MSCI relies almost entirely on recurring revenue. In Q3 2025, 98% of total revenue was recurring, with 73% of that being recurring subscription revenue. Clients such as asset managers and hedge funds enter into annual license agreements for ongoing access to MSCI's products and services, including index data. Fees are typically paid up front in advance of the service period, often for a fixed annual amount based on factors such as the number of users, locations, and the volume of data and services used. The company's subscription revenue is generated broadly across the globe. 45% of recurring subscriptions are in the Americas, 39% in Europe and Middle East, and 16% in Asia/Pacific. And this revenue is spread widely across customer types as well. 46% from asset managers, 16% from banking and brokerages, 13% from asset owners, and 10% from hedge fund managers. Recurring revenue that is not overly reliant on any one region or customer category increases the reliability of these revenue streams. The rest of the recurring revenue is primarily from asset-based fees. Instead of fixed subscription costs, asset-based fees are variable and tied to AUM in an ETF or fund linked to MSCI indexes. Asset-based fees are recurring fees, but they fluctuate with financial markets, whereas pure subscriptions provide more total stability. Through Q3 2025, 54% of index segment revenue has been from recurring subscriptions. Another 43% are from asset-based fees. That 97% reliability shows the underlying stability of this business model. But index isn't the only area in which that is the case. A major player in risk management. In its analytics segment, MSCI provides risk management, performance attribution, and portfolio management tools, providing institutional investors an integrated view of risk and return across portfolios. The company's offerings give clients the ability to analyze exposures such as market risk, credit risk, ESG, environmental, social, and governmental, exposure, and liquidity, data that can be incredibly complex to view in large-scale portfolios and organizations. To date, 23% of MSCI total revenue is in the analytics segment. In the past, investors might have thought simplistically about a stock in terms of the market return and a stock's beta, its volatility relative to the market. Today's risk models are considerably more sophisticated, driven heavily by data analytics looking at different factors that contribute to the performance of stocks. The goal is to disaggregate various style factors that move stocks one way or the other, and focus on what's real. These style factors are things like momentum, in which funds tend to chase stocks that are rising and shun those that are not. Other style factors are concepts like company size, perceived quality, dividend yield, perceived growth, and valuation. The idea is to separate out these factors that are more difficult for investors to truly research and instead isolate the stock-specific portion of a stock's returns. Finding idiosyncratic ideas is what separates the best stock pickers from the rest. The interplay of all these factors in a single stock is incredibly complicated. When measured over an entire portfolio, it would be a tall order for the average investor to effectively evaluate. MSCI's risk models make this impossible task possible for clients. The company sees over a $1 billion total addressable market, TAM, for analytics on the equity investing side. Asset managers are increasingly customizing portfolios through end-user applications, so more client-specific applications and more ability for clients to develop their own customized indexes. Clients are also becoming more numbers-driven, consuming large amounts of model data into their investment processes. MSCI distributes content through APIs, which connect key aspects of one software application with another, and other digital avenues to help make that possible. More complicated portfolios demand even more complex analytical tools. That's why MSCI sees an even bigger opportunity in multi-asset class solutions for its analytics segment. The company sees a $2 billion TAM as clients look both to build more complex portfolio structures and also manage them across multiple asset classes, driven by a strong performance from multi-strategy funds compared to the more mature traditional equity market. MSCI's analytics segment generated just over $700 million in revenue in 2025, and 97% of analytics segment revenue comes from recurring subscriptions. But it's important to point out that stability doesn't mean stagnation. Run rate segment revenue at the end of Q3 was approaching $750 million. But with a $3 billion TAM, there is a long runway for growth. Leading in the fuzzy worlds of sustainability and climate, MSCI got to its market-leading positions by seeing the future of investing more clearly than anyone else. Nowhere is that more evident than in the company's sustainability and climate segment. MSCI was one of the earliest data providers to think about ESG. The company has spent over 45 years in ESG, objectively measuring and modeling different characteristics of sustainability. While ESG is often politicized, the reality is that it is actually a very practical business endeavor for MSCI. Sustainability matters because companies that prioritize and measure environmental sustainability are better prepared to meet regulatory standards implemented in the name of climate change. In its sustainability and climate segment, MSCI offers products and services that help institutional investors understand how sustainability considerations can play a role in long-term portfolio risks and returns. And the company supports these efforts in a big way. MSCI has over 4,700 sustainability and climate equity and fixed income indexes. More than 1,600 MSCI employees are devoted to this, including experts and technologists providing the most efficient investment signals. Measuring sustainability seems rather qualitative and subjective by nature, but as one might expect, MSCI has taken a highly quantitative and data-driven approach. The company's sustainability and climate offerings are based on 7 million data points each month with inputs from thousands of news sources, corporate websites, and interactions with company contacts. That approach has made MSCI a thought leader in the space, and the numbers show that there is client demand. MSCI is the number one sustainability index provider as measured by ETF assets linked to its sustainability indexes. Over $1.1 trillion in assets are benchmarked against those indexes, and 49 of the top 50 largest asset managers in the world use MSCI's research on ESG. Today, 11% of company revenue is in the sustainability and climate segment, and 98% of that revenue is from recurring subscriptions, and the underlying growth has been massive. Run rate segment revenue has increased at a 27% compound annual growth rate, CAGR, since 2010. But sometimes even the best businesses face obstacles behind their control. With President Donald Trump in office, there has been investor concern that companies would subordinate, or totally wipe out, ESG investing. And that has happened, to some extent. Segment revenue growth was 21% in both 2022 and 23, but in 2024, sustainability and climate revenue growth slowed to 9%. In Q3 2025, new subscriptions for the segment fell 21% from the same period a year ago to $7.4 million. Management expects that demand will likely remain soft for the next few quarters. Yet even during this slowdown, Sustainability and climate segment revenue has increased 10% this year. MSCI's growth in the ESG area is far from over. Owning share in the opaque world of private assets. Private assets represent a small 9% of company revenue, but this is an important growth driver for MSCI. Private assets focuses on data, analytics, and indexes for illiquid investments that aren't listed for trading on traditional exchanges. These assets often don't have clear market prices or risk metrics, making it challenging for clients to evaluate these assets, both in terms of individual performance and in a broader portfolio context. But similar as with other asset classes, MSCI provides tools in private assets to help investors benchmark performance, manage risk, and integrate these assets into public asset portfolios. MSCI has bolstered its capabilities in private assets through key acquisitions, gobbling up Real Capital Analytics in 2021 to strengthen its commercial real estate data and analytics capabilities, and the Burgiss Group in 2023. Burgiss Group adds comprehensive private capital data, analytics, and platforms such as Private Eye, a web-based tool with portfolio risk and performance data sourced directly from limited and general partners in relevant funds, and CASA, which cover private equity, real estate, and other privately held asset categories. Private market assets continue to show robust growth. According to S&P Global, private markets AUM grew just over 25% in 2025 from the prior year. MSCI has 130 indexes covering 15,000 different private funds and over $12 trillion in AUM. Private markets opaqueness might be a benefit for MSCI, as clients trust MSCI private market data because of the company's strong reputation and history as an index leader and provider of benchmarking statistics. And because MSCI's private data is 100% sourced directly from limited partners in private funds, the data is highly reliable and provided on as much of a real-time basis as possible. An added bonus for MSCI is that competition is light in the private asset field. A big barrier to entry is replicating the complicated infrastructure. The company collects data from over 500 vendors, it manages over 1,000 different data products, and maintains data on over 16 million securities each day. This requires over 1.4 trillion instruments being priced each day. After gathering and making sense of that data, MSCI delivers it to clients through over 1,300 APIs, application programming interfaces, for example, that allow data to feed into a user's Microsoft Excel, 15 different proprietary applications, and 70 different third-party distribution partners. For MSCI, it is critical to stay ahead of the technology curve. MSCI One, proprietary data in the cloud. Nowhere is this more evident than in the launch of MSCI One, a cloud-based, open architecture platform developed by MSCI and built on Microsoft's cloud computing platform Azure. Launched in December 2022, MSCI One serves as a unified, integrated access point for global institutional investors to MSCI's extensive portfolio of analytics, data, indexes, risk management tools, climate solutions, ESG ratings, and other investment decision support products. The mission of MSCI One is to provide customers with an integrated experience. That means a modern, web-based interface with seamless navigation across MSCI's tools, combining cloud delivery, interactive dashboards, and flexible data distribution. MSCI One users can synthesize vast amounts of data into actionable views, allowing clients to quickly identify risks and opportunities through its cloud-based risk analytics tool MSCI Risk Insights. The MSCI Climate Lab feature similarly helps measure, monitor, and manage climate-related risks across portfolios. And the experience is customized for each customer across asset classes including equities, fixed income, private assets, and multi-asset portfolios. But one key feature of MSCI One is how the company is integrating artificial intelligence, AI, into its offering. A big part of MSCI One is AI Portfolio Insights, a generative AI-powered risk management solution launched in June 2024. AI Portfolio Insights combines MSCI's advanced risk and performance modeling with generative AI to modernize portfolio analytics for institutional investors, risk managers, and portfolio teams. AI Portfolio Insights surfaces the most important changes in portfolio risk and performance, highlighting key drivers such as sectors, issuers, or market events with narrative summaries before the workday starts. AI is also used in anomaly detection and trend analysis. It provides an interactive AI agent, allowing users to ask plain language questions. For example, what drove the risk increase in this portfolio? For customized, portfolio-specific responses. Another benefit of the AI infusion is that it enables proactive, rather than reactive, risk management. For example, A stop loss puts a limit on how much a stock can drop in price before initiating a sell for the investor holding the shares. It only acts when the share price falls a certain amount. MSCI's AI Portfolio Insights risk analytics tools are designed to be proactive, helping see risks in advance. By curating vast data volumes and using generative AI to churn out reliable explanations, it helps risk teams scale impact, speed up analysis, reduce manual effort, and better integrate risk into investment processes. Further, MSCI emphasizes safe AI adoption. That means taking measures to minimize hallucinations when generative AI makes things up, and ensuring data privacy by segregating client data. In addition to employing AI capabilities in its risk management, MSCI also recognizes that AI is one of the most powerful investment themes in the market. The MSCI Acqui Emi Robotics and AI Index represents companies associated with increased adoption of AI, robots, and automation. The MSCI Global Artificial Intelligence Index tracks 100 leading global companies advancing AI, selected via relevance scores. These reflect MSCI's view that AI is a structural megatrend driving returns in themes like robotics, digital economy, and autonomous tech, with AI-centric areas leading thematic resurgence in recent years. A deeper dive into the value of subscriptions. Now taking a broader view, let's think about the real value of a subscription business model. First of all, repeat customers are significantly more valuable than new customers. They tend to spend more because they believe in the product. Repeat customers also cost less to sell to. MSCI doesn't have to search out those new buyers with expensive advertising. This dynamic plays out in MSCI's retention rate, the percentage of customers who continue with the company the following year. That number was 94.7% in Q3 2025, continuing to hold in the 94% to 95% range in which it has consistently been for years. Low customer cancellations are a clear green signal for investors. It reflects high customer satisfaction, suggesting that past performance is indicative of future results. Part of the reason for high retention rates are high customer switching costs. MSCI data is highly integrated into the investment processes of its users. Switching is expensive. Finally, there is the mission-critical nature of the data. That level of importance and quality makes it essential for subscribers. Now let's look at profitability. Sales are great, but they only matter if they translate to the bottom line. Smart management teams price their products for value. If a product has strong retention rates due to a high value proposition and big switching costs, the company can charge premium prices, and that is what MSCI does. EBITDA margin has been a whopping 60.4% over the past 12 months. That represents single-digit margin growth over the past 5 years. Even more impressive, though, is free cash flow, FCF. MSCI has converted the $3.0 billion in revenue it has generated in the last 12 months into $1.4 billion in FCF, a 45% FCF margin. So not only are the sales here highly predictable, but they are generating a ton of cash for investors at the same time. Added up, high recurring revenue plus high profit margins plus hefty FCF equals big valuation multiple. MSCI's price-to-earnings, PE, ratio has ranged between 30 and 50 over the past 5 years. But there has been a slight drop recently, and that creates investment opportunity, as slowing subscription growth, particularly in ESG, has spooked investors. Shares are currently valued at a PE ratio of just under 30x based on 2026 numbers. That means valuation is as cheap as it has been in the last 5 years. Relative to broader market valuations, the stock looks like an even greater bargain. MSCI's PE was once more than double that of the S&P 500. But today that relative valuation is down to 130% of market levels. Again, this appears driven by the recent slowdown in subscription growth and ESG. Generally speaking, management does the right thing with its excess cash, focusing on capital return to shareholders. Historically, MSCI pays out 40% to 50% of adjusted EPS as dividends, making MSCI shares look a bit like a high-quality bond. Remaining FCF goes to stock buybacks. MSCI is a share cannibal, scooping up about 3% of shares per year, with shares outstanding down 25% since 2016. The company has bought back $1.5 billion in stock so far in 2025, but management accelerated those repurchases recently, with $1.2 billion in buybacks in Q3 alone. MSCI should generate $1.4 billion in FCF this year, 3.2% of the company's $44 billion market cap. So the stock is trading at a 3.2% FCF yield, just slightly below 10-year U.S. Treasury yields of 4.2%, but those Treasury bond payments are fixed. Meanwhile, MSCI FCF should continue to grow at 10% annually. And with such high recurring revenue, MSCI's FCF is extremely low risk. Investors should think of this stock as a cash machine with a much better growth profile than fixed income investments, but at a pretty similar price. Analyst consensus expectations are for MSCI to earn $19.35 per share in 2026. With continued growth, it could approach $22 EPS in 2027. The trend of increasing investor reliance on data for portfolio management is still intact, and the focus on ESG is still growing, slowly, but at a high single-digit rate that many companies would envy. A slowdown in 2025 represents easy comparisons ahead, which should lead to continued strong growth, and all the other factors that contribute to a strong valuation, like high retention rate, high margins, and strong FCF remain unchanged. If shares return to a historical average multiple of 40x implies an $880 stock, that's 48% above the current $595 per share. That's solid upside for a company with such a low risk earnings profile. Investors should buy this benchmark leader to beat the benchmarks. Action to take: buy MSCI, NYSE, MSCI, up to $650 per share. Porter & Company, Stevenson, Maryland. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter Stansberry's Complete Investor. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue. In addition to this issue, you should check out our top three buys where we highlight three current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point today. You can find the top three buys under the Best Buys link on our site at porterandcompanyresearch.com.